For those of you that haven't taken any of the courses or particular courses we're reviewing here, some of this stuff is just going like this. That's okay. It does go in, and it may not come out again for months or even years. But it makes imprints. In the monasteries, it's not uncommon to see a 15-year-old monk sitting in with a bunch of people that are in the 10th year of Geshe program. They don't understand what's being taught, but it does make imprints. And they just do that. So don't worry about it. If in Italy, when we were doing the 7-year course, most of the stuff was whoosh. And every so often, I guess you jump a Gelsa would look out. And he'd just laugh and laugh and laugh. And he said, relax. Relax. You aren't going to get this, you know. But some of it goes in. And it will pop up later. So don't worry about it. You know, understand what you can, what you can't. Put on the shelf. If you know what you don't understand, you can put on the shelf. Otherwise, just, you know, go home and get a good night's sleep. Which brings us, yes.
Is there a chance now to ask a question regarding the self-existence of difficult people or situations?
Say that, or I can't hear.
Okay. Okay.
It's not language, I just can't hear.
If you have a job, and it's part of the job that you have to deal with difficult people and or difficult situations and or difficult organizations, because it's part of the job, okay? And sometimes I think to myself, yeah, I mean, it's so difficult for me because I know it's not self-existence, but on the other hand, it's my job, and I have no problem if those kind of people are like they are. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's sometimes so difficult to distinguish, has it something to do with me? Did I create those people? Or is there a problem? If there is a problem, what kind of problem is? Can you say something about that? Because, you know, otherwise I have to quit my job and I cannot do this job anymore because right. This is my job.
This is an important part of our practice.
Yeah.
Yes, those people come from you.
Yeah. Yeah. But if I don't have a problem, I mean, I earn my money with that, you know. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah.
You reach a point. You know, it's common for beginning students, they first hear about karma, and then, you know, oh, right, got that, makes sense, you know. And then their response to people that are having difficult problems is, well, that's your karma. And I have a good friend in the FPMT, a Buddhist nun. Her name is Venerable Robina. She's about that tall. A kung fu expert. She was a radical feminist. And a very good friend. A very good friend. I have the boot mark, her boot marks on my butt to prove it. That's a good friend, all right? But somebody said, you know, well, I know it's my karma, you know. And she said, we're Buddhists. Yes, of course it's your karma, you know. And that doesn't do any good to give that explanation. But the thing is, yeah, all that stuff comes from us. And then how do I change that? How do I begin to reject people who cooperate, you know, who do their jobs well, who are friendly to each other, and so on?
So that means it's my job. I mean, if I have a job like that, then it's a kind. Then my job is a kind of practice.
Uh-huh. How do I change these assholes that work for me? Right?
I did not say asshole, okay?
But but it gets that way sometimes, right?
You can move your mind. You can move your mind.
You figure out ways that you change your perceptions of them. Part of that is going to include teaching them with love, mm-hmm. all right, with compassion. Part of it is going to be looking to see where those projections come from in you. And that's hard to do at first. I mean, yeah, that's me, but so what? Now what do I do, you know? When you can identify things that you've done that maybe have produced those perceptions, those projections, then you can A, purify them, and B, change the behavior so they don't occur again. So there are two things there. We are born, a human rebirth is very fortunate. You know, thing in the scriptures from Lord Buddha is consider a huge ocean as big as our solar system. And at the bottom of that ocean, there's a blind turtle that lives there. You've heard the story, right? For those of you who haven't, and don't all raise your hands, you have, because I'm going to tell it anyway. That turtle, blind turtle, comes up to the surface once a year. The surface is toss waves from storms and stuff like that, you know? And there is a lifesaver, a ring floating on the top of the ocean. So once every 100 years, the turtle comes up in this huge ocean. The chances of the turtle coming up in the middle of that ring are greater than the chance for any rebirth we have to become a human. To become a human is extremely rare. It comes from good, very good karma, but there's a lot of bad karma that comes along with it because we've come from lower realms. So part of our practice is learning how to purify some of that bad karma, meaning you make the seeds not ripen, which you really can't do, but you can lessen the impact of them. You can make them ripen in a hurry so they're not as strong. Karmic seeds grow the longer they remain in your mind stream without actually ripening as a perception. So you can make them ripen ahead of time. You can make a rebirth of the hell realms ripen as a headache one afternoon. You can have that happen. And then you begin to understand that if you're really practicing, if this path makes sense and you want to follow it, that when bad things are happening to you, like people don't get along or don't do their job right, you can view that as a purification. When you've gotten to the point where you've kind of analyzed that and are trying to do things to change your perceptions of them, you still have seeds in there, you know, that ripen in the way you don't want them to ripen. And when that happens, you can understand, okay, it's a purification. I'm not going to respond in a negative way, which means you don't replant the seed. So when that perception ends, you can rejoice. That is gone. When the seed ripens, it's gone. You know, when the corn sprouts, there's no more seed.
So can we say that consulting business is purification practice?
Oh, wow. Yeah, you can. Where do we teach purification? Three, the course six, five? Karma?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
I sort of spread it around a lot, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's in course six too.
Yeah, it happens when you get to tantra. It's very, very, very big.
It's of course 60.
One thing to do is to do good things for very powerful objects. If you want to get rich, you give money to people who really need it, you know, as opposed to giving Donald Trump a dollar, you know. He doesn't need that, you know.
Maybe.
Give it to people who need it. If you want to be healthy, go to a hospital and be in there. You know, we call them candy stripers, people that work in hospitals that are not registered nurses or anything, but they just sort of help out. Do something like that. Whatever it is you want, figure out how to help somebody get it. Somebody else. Who needs it and who wants to do that. Finding powerful objects is very important. You can set up an altar in your home with water bowls. Those are offerings to the Buddhas. Buddhas are very powerful. Or your lama or whatever it is, you know. Get in the habit of doing that. Things like that. Things will change. You'll become a really good manager. People want to work for you. And your team will be very productive. And they won't be jerks. They can move up from asshole to jerk to, wow, you know. And that will happen either by the people you don't like quitting or they change. Either way. If your spouse yells at you, you've created a yelling spouse. And you can uncreate the yelling spouse as well.
Maybe there is a misunderstanding because I am working as a consultant, so those are not my colleagues, but I help companies to create better working conditions and things like that. So I need those kind of people, otherwise I don't have customers anymore. Is there any difference?
It doesn't make any difference.
There is no difference. No. Okay. Even if I help them to develop.
Yep.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm.
Yep, you can do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
That's basically what the DCI courses are doing, basically. Without being religious. Well, without being Buddhist. I think people who kind of get that and think DCI would help them have a very strong spiritual base, which they may not call religious, but they understand, at some level, they understand karma. Why do we raise families? To produce good people. You know, even people who turn out to be terrible parents or wife beaters or child abusers or whatever, it starts out somewhere with the understanding they can make something happen. That's a very basic understanding of karma. They may not understand how it works, but it's there, you know. Even people, the hedonists, they're the eat, drink, and be merry school. Or somebody in our class in Italy said, oh, it's the shit happens school, you know. There's no cause for anything, it just happens. So eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow we die, maybe, you know. Things just happen. There's no reason for it. And that's a tremendously wrong view. The people who are trying things, you know, like that, people who go to a job think they're going to be better off somehow or other. That means they have some understanding or at least trust in cause and effect. So the trick is to find the appropriate causes for what you want to produce. You want to give the company you're paid to produce good workers for, you want to produce good workers for that company. Resolve conflicts and stuff like that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Name the three elements of the act of giving and what it means not to see them. All right. Assuming that you haven't had this course, that question will make absolutely no sense to you. And it may not even if you've had the course. So, this is talking about something called the three spheres. And that means nothing either by itself. But we have to consider three things for everything we do. And the example given here is the act of giving, the three spheres, the three parts of it. The first thing is that the thing that you give to somebody has no nature of its own. The euro that you give to a beggar on the street, which I don't think you have much around here, but, you know, that euro has no nature of its own. What's it worth then, you know? So that's the first thing to understand. Its worth is tied up into what you were trying to accomplish for that person. Your motivation. And it may be simply to give them a sandwich for lunch that they wouldn't otherwise have. But it may be also that while you're doing that, you have a very short conversation or just a smile, or you touch their hand as you give it to them, which passes on a little bit of warmth, which might make them feel better. And wonder why do I feel that way from this person? And set them on a little different path. So the thing that you give in the act of giving has no nature of its own. It is empty of being what it looks like it is. The second thing is the emptiness of the person receiving the gift. So that beggar, or your llama, if you're giving something to your llama, has no nature of its own. When you're making love with your partner has no nature of their own. You have to understand that. And the third thing then is, you don't either. There's actually four things here. The act itself has no nature of its own. We must always understand these three spheres. The person you're doing something to or with, the thing itself, if it involves giving or yelling back at your boss, for example. You know, if you understand that your yelling back has no nature of its own either, why the hell are you doing it? You know, that'll sink in one day. Well, that's dumb, you know. And whatever act you're involved in has no nature of its own either. Bodhisattvas practice six professions. The first one is giving, which is why it's an example here. The second one is
morality,
living an ethical way of life. The third one,
not getting angry
when the time comes that you normally get angry. Patience, it's called. Fourth one,
joyful effort.
you get off doing good things. You're happy about it. You really like doing it. Five.
Concentration.
Which is usually interpreted as sitting down and meditating. And it is that, but you also do it when you're not on the cushion. You're involved in what you're doing, single-pointedly. It's why it's a bad thing to text when you're driving. Or to drive when you're texting. You know? Single-pointed. What am I doing right now? And that's where your mind is. And you sit down on the cushion and apply that same kind of concentration in order, first of all, to have a direct perception of emptiness. And second of all, to increase your understanding of that on the path of habituation. From the point of time that you have a direct perception of emptiness up until you rid yourself of every one of your mental afflictions so that they will never, ever again occur. Or you become a Buddha. That path there means you're just enabling your mind to understand emptiness much more strongly so that you can reach a point where you're never not in a state of understanding emptiness. And then you're a Buddha. Well, you're probably an arhat if you're lower level. You're in a state of constant meditation on bliss. But there's nobody else around. It's just you yourself. So we want to help everybody, so we have to go beyond that level. So those are the three spirits, and you apply them to everything you're doing. The person I'm trying to help has no nature of their own. Therefore, they can be helped. The help I'm trying to give has no nature of its own. But it is a projection of my mind. So I need to get my mind in the right spot to make sure I'm giving a good help, right? Meaning you also have to understand what the person needs you're trying to help. And then the help you are giving them, the content of it, has no nature either. And then you add yourself, I have no nature. But the three spheres are the recipient, the act itself, and the thing that's transpiring. And that can be you. And that is class one. And now's the time for questions. They don't have to be about this, but if there's something unresolved.
Can you explain this, the three spheres for the perfection of wisdom? You have the emptiness of yourself and the emptiness of wisdom. And what is the third sphere?
Well, it would be the mind that's... All right. The emptiness of self means there is no self, independent of my projection of who Venerable Phil is, okay? But that's not a mind that is wise, understanding emptiness. That's different. And that requires a lot of sophistication. And you'll get to it.
Okay.
In fact, you're going to start Monday, so. Wisdom The perfection of wisdom is the result of the first five perfections. I think we did that in course something or other. It was either 10, 11, or 12, or it was 7, I forget. It may have been both. And every other time I talk about it too. So, and the interesting thing here, a perfection, the Tibetan word is paroltu. And parol means to go across, like cross a river. You're reaching the other shore. All right. Once you've gotten there, there's no place else you can go to get closer to it. You're already there. Tibetan is a language of sheep and yak herders, basically. They were nomads. They had no written language until about 700 AD. They sort of began to understand that there were more people like them, and they set out to conquer the world, and they did. They occupied the Forbidden City in Beijing. They were the emperors of China and Mongolia. And then that kind of turned around. But they became Buddhist. They discovered everybody around them that was sort of organized were Buddhists. So they decided to find out what that was about. And in order to do that, they needed texts. And they had to translate those texts from Sanskrit. And they needed an alphabet. So they developed that. But the language is still very simple. So what we call perfection, they understand as having gone as far as you can towards something. And once you've gotten there, that's it. It's ultimate. It's a perfection. So when we're talking about the perfection of giving, we're talking about reaching the point where in your mind, you reach a point where it cannot be developed any further. It is now perfect. And basically it means that if somebody needs something and you've got it and you think it will help them, you'll give it just like that, including your eyeball if necessary. It's inconsequential. Cut off your arm. Yeah, right like that. It is so important that you will do whatever it takes. If you have the thing that the person needs, you'll give it like that. Morality, the second perfection, you behave in an ethical way towards all people regardless. We have 10 non-virtues, which are basically the 10 commandments. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. But there's an opposite. The opposite of killing is protecting life. The opposite of stealing is helping people get things, and so on. The opposite of sexual impurity is sexual purity, mainly respecting other people's relationships and helping foster them, and so on. So that you act in a beneficial way towards every other living being, regardless of who they are. You have absolute love for them. You have compassion. You can't stand to see them suffer. And it doesn't matter what they're like. The worst murderers, you know, sexual predators, whatever it turns out, lousy presidents, whatever it turns out to be, your heart is full of love for them. And the same with the other perfections. When you get to wisdom, wisdom is kind of the result of those other four. But basically, it's the fact that you understand that nothing has nature, any nature of its own. And you practice those on what we call the bodhisattva grounds, the bodhisattva levels. You don't enter the bodhisattva levels until you've had a direct perception of emptiness. When you have a direct perception of emptiness, you are automatically on the first ground, meaning you're practicing the perfection of giving. So this perfection of wisdom then, which we say comes after the first five, it doesn't. You practice all six at the same time. And simultaneously too. But it's much more than a direct reception of emptiness. But it is not yet Buddhahood. So you got to work, you know, beyond that. Why am I talking about this? Somebody asked something. You asked something. Oh, wisdom. Yeah, right. What are the three spheres of the perfection of wisdom? Well, it's understanding that your mind is empty. It has no nature of its. I mean, and you really do understand that to the point of view, you don't have to, from the point that you don't have to think about it. It's just there. All right. You understand that everything else is empty. You understand that the Buddhas are empty. You understand that the hell beings are empty, and so on. And that your mind is simply a product of your karma, the way you treated other people. And by that point, you've changed your behavior sufficiently that A, you no longer have any negative seeds. Well, negative emotions, let me put it that way. There is nothing that can disturb your mind. A negative emotion is something that disturbs your mind, right? And you've generated all these good seeds to be able to practice like a bodhisattva. And when you reach that point, if you're on the Buddha path, you have reached the realization of somebody who's simply on the lower path that wants out of suffering. You've reached nirvana. And then you begin to work on the mental obstacles which prevent you from being omniscient. And when those are complete, beyond the perfection of wisdom, the perfection of wisdom in the sixth ground, there are 10 of them. So there's 4 more grounds to go through, and they are all mental. You know, developing your wisdom, getting rid of the obscurations to omniscience, the obstacles to omniscience. And then one day, and it is just like that, you're a Buddha. You can be in this body, but you're a Buddha. We have some certificates.